Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Well, good afternoon to everybody. This is another of our Sunday afternoon webcasts. We've moved our location from the sala at Amravati to the temple, for those of you who are not physically present here. So this is a bit of an experiment to hold the Dhamma session in a slightly different environment, so that I hope it works out all right. So I thought I'd begin this afternoon by offering a few reflections about gratitude. So each week, as the days go by and different things come up in people's conversations, or things that are brought to my attention, or things that come up in my own reflections, and last week I was talking about equanimity, upekā, and this week I thought to offer a few reflections about gratitude, because the pandemic situation around the world brings up a lot of fear and aversion and restlessness and a lot of tension, conflict, and so forth, a lot of afflictive emotions. And so I feel it's also good to be bringing to our attention the things that we can be grateful for, or to reflect upon the quality of gratitude itself, because as people have been, say, seeing from news reports, or hearing from each other, or just say, you know, picking up through conversations here and there, there's a tremendous amount of good, extraordinary acts of unselfishness and kindness, generosity, people making extraordinary efforts to help each other. As people are aware, there are numerous nurses, doctors, paramedics, service drivers, bus drivers, ambulance drivers, people working in hospitals. In this country alone, apparently over 100 medical personnel have passed away, have died from the COVID-19 infection, coronavirus, and around the world, many others as well. So I feel that sense of gratitude and say the quality of appreciation for the good that is being done is also part of the picture. So in the language of the Pali scriptures, the word for gratitude is katanyuta. And so this is a very beautiful quality, a wholesome quality. And so that is something that the Buddha encouraged, and a conscious cultivation of gratitude. And this is not just for the people who physically help us, say that nurses, doctors, people who provide, say, physical support or medical support in times of illness and difficulty. But in particular, it's also gratitude for our spiritual teachers. I mean, I realize I'm sitting up on a high seat being a spiritual teacher, so I'm not saying you should be grateful to me, but rather this is a principle that the Buddha points out, that yeah, along with the physical needs that we have and the way that our life functions in the world on a material level, also our spiritual needs are extremely important, if not even more important. So when we cultivate a recollection or a quality of gratitude, we begin with our spiritual teachers and our parents. These are right at the top of the list of those for whom we're encouraged to cultivate gratitude. So I feel that this is something that is very noble and useful to do, and to consciously bring to mind those beings in our life, both here in the present time, And also in our past, those beings who have helped us, and to be consciously recognizing that sense of appreciation, of gladness that they did what they did, and they have provided the example that they have. They've given us the support and the blessings that they have. So our physical parents, whether we know them or not, or whether we even like them or not, because obviously not every family has sweet and delightful relationships between parents and children. But still, our parents were the way that we came into the world. And even if we have had a tense or a difficult relationship with our parents, still the gift of the human condition, to be the capacities that we have as a human being, the opportunity that we have living in the world as we do, at a time where we are able to to develop wholesome qualities, to live in skillful ways, to know the Buddha's teaching, to live at a time when skillful spiritual teachings exist in the world, and to be able to apply those, having the time, the energy, the capacities of mind and body to apply those teachings to our lives. That's an amazing thing. And it's frequently pointed out in the suttas how rare in the world it is to be born as a human being, or rare to be born in a time where the Buddha's teachings are in the world, and rare indeed to have the opportunity to understand them, to practice them, and to be, say, enabled to free the heart from all delusion, to bring the wholesome qualities, the wholesome potentials that we have to fulfillment. That's an amazing thing, a rare thing. And so to be grateful for this opportunity that our families, particularly our parents, have provided. Also, our spiritual teachers who've helped us to see the importance, the central quality. How if we ignore those spiritual values, if we build our life around materialistic concerns, or we build our life around ambition or competition, or feelings of revenge or hurt, or spiteful feelings, negative feelings, grudges towards other people. We can spend our time and energy in that way, but what result does it bring? So so katanyuta is that quality of gratefulness, and to at least to be holding that up and knowing that's a good direction to set for ourselves is a skillful thing. Another partner word for katanyuta is katavedi. So often they're put together, katanyu, katavedi, as a single term. Katavedi is what we do as a result of feeling grateful. So being grateful towards our spiritual teachers or our parents or those who have helped us in our lives, being grateful towards the National Health Service in this country, towards all the nurses and the doctors, the many healthcare providers, supporters, support workers that are doing so much, working so hard to help us to function. So katavedi is, well, what do you do in response to that? What do you, say, bring into being as a result of that grateful feeling? So it's in a way a call to action, or it's not exactly a debt. Sometimes in English the word katavedi is translated as the debt of gratitude, but it's not quite a debt. It's sort of that being the case, what does your heart move towards? That being that grateful, appreciative feeling, what does your heart incline towards? And so then I feel it's also good in terms of gratitude to be thinking in that way. How can I work with my mind, my body, my life, my words, to express or to show that gratefulness, to be a way of not repaying, but what would be appropriate, what would be lovely, beautiful to bring into the world, having received these blessings, these gifts, what is a suitable, beautiful way to respond? So many, many years ago, as people connected with this community will know, and Lumpo Sumedho was a young bhikkhu and had gone off to India to go on Tudong, to travel around India on foot and to visit the holy places for a number of months back in the early 70s. While he was there, he was struck by this very powerful sense of katanyuta, of gratitude towards Lumpo Cha, the way that Ajahn Chah's teachings had really turned his life around, had made such a difference, and was a resource of tremendous freedom and happiness and spiritual blessing. So he was moved by this feeling of gratitude. And so when he went back to Thailand and paid his respects to Lumpo Cha, when he returned to Wat Phong to pay his respects to Lumpo Cha, then the gesture of Katawedi was for him to say, Lumpo, I offer you my life. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it. My life is yours to do with as you wish. And as someone pointed out, that there was no tape recorder there at the time, but Lumpo Cha probably said something along the lines of, which is the Northeast Thai way of saying, yes, I hear you, or okay, duly noted, or that's a good thing, or okay, Sumedho, you're feeling inspired. That's not a bad thing. But it was a way of receiving that gesture of katavedi, of quality of gratefulness being responded to by saying, please, however I can be helpful, whatever I can do to support you in the work that you do, then please let me know. I'm ready to help. So at this time here in the UK, then we have a lot of effort is being made, tremendous effort. Here Amaravati, our community, is being supported very directly with a lot of very skillful advice. People are continuing to provide food and material support for us. So there's a very strong feeling of gratitude and appreciation for the undimmed generosity and care that people are showing towards us. Also, various doctors and advisors that are, giving us helpful directions about how to look after our community. But also in the wider sphere around the country, you have the well-known now Colonel Tom Moore, had his 100th birthday a couple of days ago, who started to walk up and down his garden on his walker to raise funds for the National Health Service. And his effort at the age of 99, he wanted to do 100 laps before his 100th birthday, and so caught the public imagination that he's raised over £30 million to support the National Health Service, which is kind of amazing. And he's become something of a hero. They boosted him from being a captain to a colonel. So on his 100th birthday, he got a military promotion to being a colonel. But also, you know, the kind of efforts and gestures that people are making, and literally laying down their lives, nurses, doctors, carers, literally dying in the line of duty for us. And this is an extraordinary, wonderful thing. So in terms of katavedi, how do we repay, or how do we, say, respond to the generosity and the effort that is being made to support us as a community, as a nation in the world? I think that, you know, the first thing is to try and stop yourself getting the virus so that you're not burdening the health service more than necessary. But also, just on a much more immediate basis, just doing what we can to cultivate that which is wholesome. When unwholesome mind states, feelings of anxiety and aversion and fear, restlessness, self-criticism, when they arise, you know those as unwholesome and make the effort to let go of them. Consciously cultivate the wholesome, deliberately bringing into being qualities of loving kindness, of compassion, of well-wishing, developing the mind that is focused, developing the mind that is wise and awake, and that making the effort to bring wholesome qualities into being, and what wholesome qualities have arisen, to maintain those in being, just moment by moment, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day. And even though the mind might think, well, that's just me in my room, or me in my kuti, or this is what good is this contributing? But the degree to which we can say let go of the unskillful qualities of mind that arise, the degree to which we can cultivate the wholesome and maintain that in being, that has an effect on the people that you live with. It's the fabric of this monastery is not these buildings, like we're sitting in the temple, but the temple is not the monastery. We have a whole rebuilding program. You know, we put a lot of time and effort and energy into, but the buildings are not really the monastery. You know, without the people, this would just be a collection of buildings. Even if we have the most perfectly constructed and ideally formed eco-friendly buildings on this piece of ground, if there aren't the people wishing to train the hearts and to be awake, to be wise, to free the heart from greed, hatred, and delusion, there isn't a monastery. There's a collection of buildings on a piece of ground in Hertfordshire. And so the monastery is the people, and you are the people, each one of us. And even though we might think, well, if I wasn't here, it would still go on. But I really do like to encourage this understanding. And outside of Amaravati, in our own homes, just in the workplace, those who are frontline workers who are carrying on during this time, people isolated in their own homes, their flats, their houses, the degree to which each one of us, moment by moment, can cultivate the wholesome, let go of the unwholesome, just moment by moment, minute by minute, hour by hour. That all contributes to the well-being of the society. We're doing our bit just by not complaining, not getting say lost in our own self-critical mood, not getting into an explosive rage because you can't go out for a second walk today. But it's by each immediate local action, where each mind moment that we work with this life that we have, and recognizing the unwholesome and letting go of it, cultivating the wholesome and maintaining it. That's the way that we most sort of completely respond, or the best kind of katavedi, I would say. And then the way that those cultivation of wholesome states and the letting go of unwholesome states, the degree to which that can connect with the outside world or can influence the work that people are doing, then you know, we do what we can. So that just having this webcast once a week and the various different events that we are supporting and the different materials we put up on the website and so on, it's interesting to see how many people around the world, around this country as well, that are plugging in, that they're saying, oh, it's so helpful to have the materials on your website to read these books or hear these talks. This is something that's a major support. So that I'm not saying that it's sort of me alone at all in this effort, but this is all around the planet. Different spiritual resources are available to people, and it's in a way those spiritual resources and psychological supports that are available that help the nurses, the doctors, the drivers, the cooks, the frontline operators and people taking responsibility for the dealing with the disease, that they are in various different ways helping people all over the planet. So I have great confidence that even though we might not be walking the hospital corridors or distributing meals to people in their homes, what we do here is of vital importance and of immediate and helpful benefit to the greater society, the human family around the world. And maybe just to say a little bit about in terms of gratitude, the opposite of gratitude. So there's the kind of anti-gratitude mind states is where we get unconsciously drawn into our own entitlement. I lived in California a long time, so they would speak in terms of having entitlement issues. So the this kind of delusion that the world is supposed to be set up for me, to be convenient for me, to be in accordance with my preferences and my expectations, what I like, what I want. And I am entitled to have it that way. And if it's not that way, then it's appropriate or it's quite right for me to get angry, get upset, and to be aggrieved. So those kind of feelings are understandable enough, but they're not liberating, they're not ennobling, and they don't lead to a quality of ease or freedom or benefit for yourself or those around. So that I feel that just note amongst the unwholesome states that arise, noticing those ungrateful, entitled feelings as and when they come up, because it's important to know those. It's good to know those, and to not let the heart be swayed by that, to be moved by that sort of, well, what about me, or that's not fair, or I want one too. Again, it's understandable, it's natural enough, but it's quite a childlike mentality. It's one of the questions this afternoon is about maturity and immaturity. I would say that there's habits of entitlement, complaining, criticizing. If I'm unhappy, it's your fault. Yeah, I'm suffering and it's because of you. You know, you're the cause of my suffering, so you should do something so I will be happy. That, again, it's natural enough, common enough for us to feel that way, but it's a quite a childlike and immature way of thinking and seeing, and that you are assuming that the world is supposed to be making you feel comfortable and happy and satisfied all the time, and the world can't really do that. So part of the blessing of the Buddha's teaching is to help us to grow up from those more childlike states and having those attitudes of entitlement and blaming the world outside for our suffering, but to see, yes, maybe somebody has said something or done something that is inappropriate or unkind or destructive. Yes, you're not pretending that behavior is beautiful or good, but you still recognize it's up to you. It's up to this heart. You know, what is done with that painful feeling, those painful words or those harmful actions? What do we do with them? What choice do we make in our own heart? What do we bring to that? And one of the most wonderful and powerful aspects of the Buddha's teaching, and it's in a way it's almost sort of a challenge to the Buddha puts out, is saying it's up to you. You know, the even in the face of pain and difficulty, with physical illness, and your lungs can't breathe, and you have a high temperature, it's still up to you whether you make it into suffering or not, whether you create it as something that shouldn't be in that way. That even something that is painful, that is difficult, that you would never ask for, that is really, say, uncomfortable and life-threatening, it's still in that moment up to each one of us. What do we do with that? And so it's quite a challenging teaching. It's quite it asks a lot of us. But I feel that's part of its beauty and its strength, is that it's a teaching that helps us to grow up. We are challenged to rise up to that, to see if we can find a place in the heart where even when something's being done that is really harmful and destructive and foolish, that we're not just lost in aversion or fear or reaction or, like, you know, how dare you, indignation, but we're able to not get lost in complaining and criticizing, but rather, okay, well, that's a really harmful, destructive thing that's being done, or this is a really painful and difficult condition of the body. Okay, what can be done with this? What's the best way to handle this so that the heart responds to that difficulty and the stressing situation from a place of wisdom, from attunement, rather than from a place of reactivity and entitlement and complaining? So let's have a look at the questions for this week. The first one says, Ajahn, My sister just lost a loved one. She is asking how to go through the grieving process skillfully. Thanks. Well, the going through the grieving process skillfully is something that very crosses religious barriers all around the world, regardless of your religious conditioning or lack of it. We all have that experience of people close to us dying and those feelings of grief and loss. One of the things that often comes up in a Buddhist context is that people sometimes feel guilty for feeling grief. They say, I shouldn't be so attached, you know, but I'm really sad. You know, my mother just died, or my best friend just died. I shouldn't feel anything, should I? Or it was 2 weeks ago, and I still haven't got over it. And so many, many times when people ask, it's not uncommon for people to speak in that way, to ask that kind of question. So that what I frequently say is how if we are a Buddhist, we're still going to have feelings. And just because you have faith in the Buddha's teaching and you have derived benefit from Buddhist meditation and such like, doesn't mean that our emotions are switched off, or that we don't have those feelings of sadness when someone close to us, someone who's been a part of our life, passes away. It's completely natural. So I feel that one of the first things to do is to recognize that feeling of sadness, of grief, of loss is part of our conditioning. If we've created the causes for a bond between us and others, between us and a parent or a loved one, a child or a sibling or a romantic partner or a friend, then the effect when that breaks, when somebody dies, then that's naturally going to bring a painfulness with it. So that the kind of advice that I like to give is to not be in a hurry for those sad feelings to be disappearing, but to recognize this is the effect of a natural cause. It's because of this cause, then here's the effect of it. And just because it's painful, even if there's tears running down your face, you don't have to be pushing that away. Because even when we're feeling something painful or sad, the heart can still be at peace with that. It doesn't need to be held as a problem, or that it shouldn't be this way. When the mind gets lost in thinking about a situation, I shouldn't be this way, or that if only we got to the hospital on time, or if only that this person, if only he had listened to me and had gone to the right doctor, then things would have been different, and all of that, if only, wouldn't it have been good that, and I should have, all of those, say, mental reactions around a death of someone, or regretting all the things you didn't say, or that I wish we'd had a last conversation, or that the last time we spoke we had an argument, I really wish we had patched that up. So much of that is just the mental proliferation around the feeling of loss, and so the more the mind gets absorbed into that, then it creates much more anguish and stress around that feeling of sadness and grief. So that I feel to grieve skillfully is in a way to let those feelings of sadness and loss just wash through the system. In a way, it's letting the grief flow through the heart, through the mind, and to, when it's there, to let it be there, but not to not let the thinking mind get hold of it and to be, say, creating a whole tangle of if onlys and I should haves around it, and recognize that it's a natural process, and there's a beauty in it, a naturalness in it as well. There's a sutta that I often quote where in the few months before the Buddha's final nibbana, parinibbana, both Venerable Sariputra and Venerable Moggallana passed away. And there's a particular occasion where the Buddha makes the remark, when he's giving a Dhamma talk in a large assembly, he says, it feels as though the assembly is empty now that Sariputra and Moggallana are no longer here. So even the Buddha has that feeling of even though there's hundreds of people gathered here, somehow it seems empty because these two great beings have passed on, and they're no longer living in the world. And so I feel that's a very powerful teaching, just in that the Buddha is able to express his own sadness. These people who he'd spent his whole teaching career close to and had helped him so much, had been so much a part of the whole establishment of the Sangha and the Dhamma teaching in the world, and then the Buddha says, oh, it feels like this. The place is empty because these two great beings are not here. But also, the Buddha knew, he was an arahant, so he knew how not to make any kind of complications around that. That would be impossible for him. But I feel that's a good example that, yes, there is a sadness, a hollowness, but there's nothing wrong with that. And that those waves of grief go through us. I remember when my father had died, and I was this was 27 years ago now, and where I was staying with my mother and my sisters at the family home, and just after his funeral. And every so often you get the feeling that he was about to walk into the room, or you'd hear a sound and you were just about to start up a conversation, and then it wasn't Dad because he's died. And then there'll be this wave of, oh, he's gone. That's right. He's not going to be appearing in the doorway. He's not going to be in his favorite armchair anymore. Oh. And then there's, that kind of feeling would wash through the system. And that's so common for all of us in our families, in our living situation, and to just let those feelings, those waves of sadness, that kind of an ache of the heart, just let it wash through the system and let it be what it is. It's just a painful that's something beautiful, something good is being done in memory and in honor of that person. So that's also a very skillful way of both remembering the person and letting their name be associated with skillful action in the world. So when the body has been understood as not self, does that mean one is free of any fear of death or physical pain related to it? Well, it kind of depends what you mean by fear. As I often like to point out, fear exists because it's a very useful psychological quality in the natural world. That our ancestors that were not afraid had short lifespans because they didn't stay back from the edge of the cliff, or when they heard that rustle in the bushes, they didn't pay attention or move away from it. So they're the ones who got attacked by the saber-toothed tiger, or they fell off the cliff, or they lived in a reckless way. So fear is a very powerful protective device. So that I'd say insight into the body being not self, there are still the instinctual urges to protect the body. You don't, I'd say it's standing at the, in the days when we used to be out on the road and cross roads and there was traffic on the roads, it's sensible to be blessed with fear. You know, you pay attention to what the traffic is doing on the road, or say for example with the coronavirus protection protocols that we have here at Amravati, an insight into the body being not self doesn't mean that you become reckless. You stop washing your hands, or you ignore the social distancing protocols, or you suddenly feel that none of that applies to you because you understood that the body is not self. I'd say that's a wrong understanding or a wrong grasping of insight, because the fear as a sort of neurotic reaction is one thing. So maybe if there's the realization of the body is not self, is the fear of death or the ending of the body, that in itself as a concept won't be frightening or off-putting at all. But That doesn't mean to say that you don't take care, you don't follow the natural impulses to protect your life, to look after your injuries, to take care of your illnesses, to stay back from the edge of the cliff. It doesn't mean that you're, say, unmindful and looking after the well-being of the body. So I think you need to, in a way, tease those things apart. You can be not afraid of physical pain, but it's still painful. So the idea of having a lot of pain, or if you have cancer, or with the COVID-19 symptoms of having terrible shortness of breath and the lungs being heavily compromised, the idea of that might not be frightening as a sort of a concept. Saying, well, you know, I'm not afraid of that as a thing that might happen, but when it's there, if you can't breathe or there is intense pain, then there's still going to be a recoiling from it. There's going to be the natural reactive. It's still painful. So again, I think it's important to tease those things apart, so that when there is insight, when there's true mindfulness and wisdom, then the mind doesn't create complication around pain, around death, around illness. But it's still extremely important to be following the kind of intuitive that you do what you can to stay healthy, you do what you can to reduce danger and pain, you do what you can to not cause harm to yourself or others by your own reckless behavior. So, but I think that probably what's the essence of that question is that when the mind imagines physical death or illness or physical pain, the idea of it is not threatening. You don't feel, oh dear, whatever I have to do to avoid that happening, I'll do it. I can't bear that. That the mind doesn't create that kind of a story. And over and over again, in the Buddha's teaching, when he's either the Buddha or the other enlightened disciples are giving guidance to people with illness, then they are encouraging that sense of being open to those feelings of pain and difficulty. I think there's a venerable Sariputta goes to visit Anathapindika, a lay disciple. He says, I hear you've been very ill. I hear you've been suffering a lot of physical distress, and I hope that your illness is diminishing. I hope your pains are diminishing. And Anathapindika says, no, my illness is not diminishing. My pains are increasing. They're not decreasing. And then it's a cause for a very beautiful teaching from venerable Sariputta at that point. But he doesn't say that the kind of the essence of the advice is to be not creating aversion or complication around the natural conditioning of illness or pain, and that we can do. So I feel that the more profound or complete the insight in the body is not self, and mind states are also not self, then the more the prospect of physical death and the prospect of pain is not off-putting. That's not something that is going to dominate our perceptions. But but I would say that when you're in the middle of it, then there's going to be reactivity. Those natural intuitive instinctual forces are going to function. But again, you don't have to make anything out of that, even as it's happening. You don't have to make a problem out of that. Again, there was a story that was often told when Jack Kornfield was a monk with Ajahn Chah in the late 60s, and they went to visit a branch monastery down on the Cambodian border, and it was quite a hilly part of the countryside. And the driver of the little pickup truck they were in, so there was the driver and Lumpo Cha and Jack Kornfield in the front of this pickup, and the driver seemed to have some kind of a death wish, and it was herring around these tight bends through the hills, and Jack was sitting there, and it was Jack telling the story, thinking, "We're going to die," and he even saw that Ajahn Chah's knuckles were a bit white, and And so Jack kept looking over and seeing if Lumpur was reacting. He said his face was very impassive, but his knuckles were a bit white. But at the end of it, then Ajahn Chah just turned to him and said, "Scary ride, huh?" So that, yeah, there was that you're going along a mountainous road at high speed with a reckless driver, and so there's that thought: are we going to live to make it to our destination or not? And you don't know. Those feelings are there, but you don't have to create a problem out of them. So, tech department, are we still working? Okay, very good. Sabbe sankhara anatta, all physical formations are not self or under personal control. So hopefully this whole system will continue to work till the end of the session. So, Ajahn, if everything is passing away anyway, why bother loving others? It brings pain and despair. What's so good about developing wisdom of anicca? Well, good question, or an interesting question. I often find there's a need to emphasize is that there's different kinds of love. So the kind of love that produces pain with separation is what is the Pali for it is piya, p-i-y-a, piya, and that's often translated as dear, that which is dear, dearness. So there's one of the main suttas that talks about this is called the Piya Jataka Sutta, the born of that which is dear, and So the Buddha points to that quality in a very direct way and says, you know, that the amount of suffering that we experience in terms of relationship is directly tied to the number of people that we hold dear. And he says, you know, if you have 100 dear ones, you have 100 pains, 50 dear ones, 50 pains, 10 dear ones, 10 pains, you know, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3. You have 2 dear ones, 2 pains, 1 dear one, 1 pain, no dear ones, no pains. So that might feel like a very cold-hearted and unappealing sort of spiritual approach. But what he's saying is that if we hold each other in that kind of a way, if the quality of piya, piyati, is what I translate as a possessive love, like you belong to me, I belong to you, I'm yours, you are mine. There's a sense of self and a sense of ownership. As long as that is in the mix, there is necessarily dukkha. Where there is, and another of the teachings on this is where there is love, there is suffering. So as long as that love is a possessive love, necessarily there's going to be dukkha coming from that. So the other kind of love is what I would translate as a liberative love, a love that is non-possessive. So when we talk about the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and serenity, equanimity, those are the kinds of love that are liberative. They are abundant, exalted, immeasurable. They're measureless. They are non-personal. So that when, say, the Buddha was described as one whose heart was filled with loving kindness and compassion, that the Buddha, you know, absolutely pure with ocean-like compassion, that compassion is non-possessive. The loving kindness of a Buddha is non-possessive. There's no owning in it. So if you the kind of love that is really useful and beneficial, and say in respect to this question, you know, why bother loving others? If the end brings pain and despair, well, it doesn't have to. That's the trick, and in a way, it's one of the basis of our life as celibate monastics. We live together as a community of women and men, and we develop the Brahma Viharas as the basis of our relationships with each other. That quality of caring and say emotional connection is the Brahma Viharas rather than possessive. Possessive state of owning each other or loving each other in personal ways, so that I would say it is very much worth the bother of creating, consciously creating metta and karuna, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, mudita, and upekha, serenity, equanimity, that it's very much worth the bother. And that because that also those qualities, they're the natural emotional tone of the awake mind. So an arahant, in terms of emotions, in terms of relationships, when the mind is fully enlightened, the way that it naturally responds to other beings is always with metta, karuna, mudita, upekha. That's it's not something forced or say conceived into being. It's like the natural disposition of the awake heart towards other beings are these what we call the Brahma Viharas. So that the wisdom of Anicca is in a way that is something that can support the development of the Brahma Viharas. The more that the quality of Anicca, the perception of Anicca, of impermanence, uncertainty is developed, then the more we are enabled, the heart is enabled to not create self and other. It doesn't form those possessive relationships. I mean, not just possessive love, but possessive hate as well. Like I hate you, you hate me, you're my enemy. I vow to have revenge on you. You know we can personalize hatred or fear. I'm afraid of you, or you're afraid of me, and we can personalize that, whether it's an attractive emotion or a divisive emotion. But the more that we develop the perception of Anicca, it's really useful in helping to free the heart from those possessive habits of needing to own each other or hate each other or fear each other. That developing the Anicca Sanya, that everything is impermanent, everything is uncertain, that it really facilitates, it supports the freeing of the heart from those personalizing habits. As the Buddha said in his teaching to Meghya, for the development of insight, they should sustain the perception of impermanence. But one who truly sees impermanence sees that all dhammas are not self. And when the heart awakens to that truth of anatta, it is then freed from the conceit of identity, from asmimana, and that is nibbana, here and now. So that in that teaching to Meghya, the Buddha spells that out, that the cultivation of that the perception of Anicca is really a direct pathway, a doorway to nibbana, to that the freeing of the heart from those personalizing habits. So, next one. Dear Ajahn, sometimes I receive verbal directions, guidances coming from an inner voice that I recognize as coming from beyond the ego. The experience that comes with it is usually one of peace and serenity. It feels natural to honor these guidances. However, it sometimes implies radical changes in one's life which is threatening to that rational mind when so much energy has been invested in a way of life that you thought was right and the best way to live. Could you please share your experience on that, Ajahn? Thank you. So yeah, hearing inner voices or receiving sort of inner guidance, whether it's what sort of shape or form that takes, so that's not an uncommon experience. Almost sometimes hearing your own thoughts in a different voice, or using thoughts form in words that you don't usually use, or that sometimes those insights arise in a very sort of clear and very coherent tone, and you think, oh my goodness, where did that come from? Well, that sounds helpful, or yeah, that looks like a good way forward. So I would suggest with any of those kinds of inner voices or that kind of guidance, it's most sensible to tread very carefully, to not assume that you've got some kind of totally reliable spiritual guide, or this is absolutely definitely the voice of wisdom, because it might not be. As with any kind of choice of direction or things to do with our life, then these kind of inner intuitions, and so I would say intuitive wisdom often can take this kind of a form, I would tread carefully. And also this is where our spiritual friends come in, the people that you live with, people that have known you for a long time, that that you should feel free. I would advise, say, feeling free to talk about these kind of things with your peers, people who know you, people who've been around you. Saying, "Well, I keep getting this sense. I think this is a really good way forward. And this sort of inner voice saying that this is a really good thing for me to do." Or in this dream, I had this being came to me in a dream, and it was very clear, very definite, and said. Made this statement that was seemed to make a lot of sense. What do you think about this? So I feel running these things past your friends, your teachers, your peers. That's a good way of getting perspective on such things, because I know a few people for whom these kind of voices are very much a part of their life. I think sometimes they run their whole lives. I've had people come to visit here, so not anybody resident, but people who literally have come and said, "Well, I was told to come here today," and then speaking with them, their whole life is being run by these inner voices that tell them to go and get in their car and drive to a certain place, or to stop on a particular corner and wait, and so that they're. I'm not trying to make fun or put people down, but. The degree to which that person has handed over their life to the sort of inner voices, this inner guidance and such like, I feel a bit uncomfortable, and so I try to say to them, "Well, you know, are you sure this is good advice that you're getting? Or so you went and waited on that corner. What happened?" They say, "Well, nobody came, but I'm sure I was supposed to be there." And so that I feel there's easily a mixture of genuine intuitions that are the voice of wisdom from within the heart, but that can get mushed together. It can get blurred together with our own fears or preferences or just random perceptions that have been picked up from here, there, and everywhere. So I feel it's important to be cautious, to tread carefully, and not to assume that everything that such inner voices say are completely reliable. Yeah. I mean, sometimes they are. The result of following them can be something that's very good. But I do feel that even though such inner voices or intuitions have proved beneficial or accurate once or twice, it doesn't mean to say that therefore everything that pops up in that way. Totally reliable. I think that's an easy way to a lot of delusion. And one of the, I think a week or two ago, there was questions about moha. You know, how do we greed and hatred, or passion and hatred are easy to see, but moha is not easy to see. I say precisely if the mind goes down that track of believing every thought that goes through our mind and every kind of direction that comes to us. That can be, it's like a hedgehog wandering into a land drain. It's very easy to go in, but very difficult to back out. You know, because of the spines, you know, if you have a little land drain that's sort of 3 or 4 inches in diameter, the hedgehog can go down the drain, but when it wants to get out, backing out is much more difficult. So I would advise treading carefully with respect to that. Okay, next one. Can you speak about maturity and immaturity in general terms and in spiritual terms? So maturity, well, speaking about Meghya, the Sutta to Meghya, the Buddha is he was staying in the, in this particular place, and Meghia was his attendant, as a young monk, and Meghia was very keen on the practice and was very ardent and motivated, and so he asked the Buddha permission, can I go off and stay in this mango grove, and I want to pursue the struggle, I'm determined to realize enlightenment. And the Buddha says, this isn't a good time, Meghia, this is not the right time, well, it'd be better if you just stay with me. And Meghia says, no, I think this is a good time, I want to pursue the struggle, I want to really go for it, hell-bent on Nibbana, as you might say. It's not quite the right expression, but but probably in this case it was hell-bent on Nibbana. So Meghia, the Buddha tries to persuade Meghia, don't do it. And Meghia won't listen, so he goes off, and then he goes and spends the day in the mango grove, and his mind is beset by all kinds of evil thoughts and feelings, and his mind is out of control all day long, and goes back to the Buddha in the evening, sort of somewhat chastened and wiser. And then the Buddha gives this very, very beautiful teaching, and says, and it starts off with the phrase, is as yet unripe. So Meghia was not ripe. He was not mature. He wasn't quite ready for that degree of A, solitude, and B, that sense of, I'm not going to move from this spot till I realize that he wasn't ripe. It wasn't the right time. He was not, the system hadn't matured enough. So then the Buddha spells out what are the things that help to bring the heart to maturity. And he gives us a very succinctly packaged set of advice. He said, for feelings of ill will, then cultivate loving kindness. For feelings of lustfulness, cultivate reflections on the unattractiveness of the body. For the chattering mind, for calming of distracted thought, develop the mindfulness of breathing. And then, so for the development of insight, of wisdom, then develop the perception of impermanence. And then he goes on to say, as I was just mentioning, so one who develops the insight into impermanence, then that leads to the insight into not-self. And one who sees not-self, the heart is freed from the conceit of identity, from asmi-mana. And that is, when the heart is free of asmi-mana, that is nibbana here and now. So that lack of maturity is something that it's good to recognize. You know, if you have a fruit, that this banana is not ripe. It's still, the skin is still green. It'll be difficult to peel and it won't taste good. It won't nourish you. The apple is still unformed. It's still, it won't taste good. And it needs to be left on the branch to ripen. The natural ripening process needs to continue. So maturity and immaturity, I think, is both in physical, in ordinary general terms, and in spiritual terms, they're very closely related. But knowing the right time, or knowing when things have matured, when the apple is ripe, or the banana is ready to eat, or when the conditions for your practice are ripe, that takes a degree of wisdom. So one of the sets of qualities that we have in the teachings is the qualities of a good person, a sapurisa, a well-rounded person. So amongst those qualities of a well-rounded person are knowing yourself, atanyutaka, knowing your own personality, knowing how you work, what makes you happy, what makes you unhappy, knowing what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, atanyuta. Also matanyuta, knowing the right amount, not just in how much food to eat, but how much rest do you need, knowing how much solitude do you need, how much human company do you need. So knowing the right amount, matanyuta. Kalanyuta is another of these qualities. So knowing the right time. Okay, yes, I feel inclined to go and do some meditation by myself, but is this the right time? Or is this when I'm supposed to be doing some other kind of a duty? Am I supposed to be, have I got another job? Or is someone else needing my presence? Is this the right time to carry this out. So that I feel that the, in respect to this about maturity, and that the more mature or spiritual maturity there is, and also on a more general level, then these qualities of a sapurisa, they describe that that sense of maturity or well-roundedness or someone who's who's got a balanced life. So the knowing dhammanutta is knowing the causes of things, where things come from. Atanyuta, knowing the effects, contemplating where things are going. So, like, where did this come from? Where is it going? So, dhammanyuta, atanyuta. Atanyuta, knowing yourself. Matanyuta, knowing the right amount. Kalanyuta, knowing the right time. Then, parisanyuta, knowing the group. Who are you talking to? What's the situation? Is this a Sunday afternoon webcast, or are you talking to one of the monks just in your own kuti? Is this a public talk with a title? Is this, are you going to visit a school? You know, who are you talking to? What's the situation? Are you with your family? Are you with fellow monastics? Where are you? What's the situation? So knowing the parisa, the group that you're with. And then pugalanyuta, I think, is the last one. It's like knowing the characteristics of the person that you're with, knowing other people. So not just knowing yourself, but if you're spending time with another person, how are they? Is this your parent, your child? Is this a fellow monastic? Is this a student? Is this a young child? Is this an old person? Is this someone who's sick or someone healthy? You know. What's the dynamic between you? So there are these seven qualities make up a sapurisa, a good person, or a well-rounded person. So I feel that's one way measuring the quality of maturity. So that if all of those seven qualities are present, constitutes an individual as being a mature human being. That's one way of thinking about it. Dear Ajahn Amaro, I am a male monastic affected by sexual desire. I've tried contemplating parts of the body and their inherent unattractive nature. This eases the strength of the feeling, but doesn't seem to get to the underlying tendency. Maybe this is due to the desire being more than just physical, i.e. a desire for connection with female energy. Any suggestions? Thank you. The encouragement of our teachers and generally in the practice and particularly living a celibate life is to don't overthink things, to not get too complicated about it, but rather rather than creating a story or a particular analysis or diagnosis, it's far more helpful to be, and this in my own experience of this, rather than thinking, you know, I've got a problem with sexual desire, or I should see it this way, maybe I should see it that way. We can. And so what I found most helpful is that, say, if the mind is carrying around that picture, like, I've got a problem with sexual desire, to say, well, wait a minute, is it there all the time? Is that something that's permanent? Is it who you are? And with many, many aspects of our training, it's the same with fear or aversion, or like, I've got a problem with Ajahn so and so. You know, he's making my life hell. And that might be a reasonable expression of a feeling, but then over the years, when I was a younger monk and things like that would come up with Lumpur Samedo. He said, well, is that monk a problem for you all the time? Like 24 hours a day? I said, well, no, not 24 hours a day. So, but even if you're in the same room, is it a problem all the time? Well, no, it comes and goes. It comes and goes. So that when we say, I've got a problem with sexual desire, or I feel sexual desire all the time, well, it's not so much that. And it's more the case, if you really look, that desire arises and passes away. And then the question, where is this coming from, arises and passes away. And there's that, is this just ordinary sexual desire, or is it something, is it a need for something more expansive or more ephemeral, something more etheric or psychological? That's also a question that arises and passes away. So what I found most helpful was, with Lumpo Sumato's guidance, was bring the attention to what the actual felt experience of the moment is, rather than creating a whole story around it, or a kind of analysis, or a, you know, theory, and then carrying the theory around, or carrying the story around, to say, well, in this moment, what's here? And what, how does this feel? What is this? And I found that, you know, because my mind does love to explain things and commentate on things, figure things out. But what I found was that that sense of bringing the attention to the actual experience of the moment, rather than, and using that as the reference point, rather than going to the story that we tell ourselves about it, how we've joined up the dots and made a particular picture, that is a far more sort of say effective and helpful way of working with those energies than by say trying to think things through. Many years ago, somebody when Lumpu Cha was in America, somebody asked him a similar question about celibacy and relationships and marriage, and talking about the sort of the divine balancing of the male and female and so forth. And Lumpu Cha was very very kind of simple and straightforward. He said it's nothing more complicated than, you know, than opposites attracting. Don't add anything to it. There's nothing more to it than a simple attraction of opposites in nature. Don't let your mind complicate it. There's nothing more to it than that. And so that I think the person who asked the question was a bit offended. You don't understand, you know? And that felt he was probably not getting the nuances of the sort of the psychological balancing of male and female and such like. I'm not trying to belittle that, but I think Lumpu Cha had a lot of experience of dealing with lustful feelings and that whole area of his longing for family life when he was young, and how his particularly in his own situation, his beloved was married in an arranged marriage to his best friend. And then they were all living in the same village. He was in the village monastery, and they were in the village as husband and wife, his former partner, or his former beloved, and her new husband, who had been his best friend. So he knew about heartbreak and the kind of pulls of the heart in those kind of ways. So I feel that's very helpful advice from him, is that there's nothing more to it than just a natural attraction of opposites. Don't let your mind create complications around it, or the complications that the mind likes to create. Just don't believe in those. Don't get drawn into that. Just that it's in its root, in its origin, its source. It's a lot more simple. Okay, so there's a last one here. Are Mara and the highest gods, and the highest of gods, the same being? Well, not to get too complicated, it's 12 minutes past three already. But according to Buddhist mythology, or some Buddhist mythologies, there are actually five Maras, not just one. And so that each of the five Maras is associated with one of the five Khandas. So the first Mara is called Machu Mara. Machu is the killer. Machu is associated with physical death. So that's associated with Rupa Khanda. Machu Mara is the first one. Mara, the killer. And the second one associated with Vedana, or feeling, is Kilesa Mara, the Mara of the defilements. So the first Mara is the Mara. Mara literally means death. So Machu Mara is Mara the killer, or physical death. So then the Kilesa Mara is the Mara of the defilements. So of sexual desire, of aversion, of jealousy, selfishness, deceit, and so forth. So the Kilesa Mara is associated with Vedana Kanda. And then the third one is Kanda Mara. So this is the Mara that takes the body and the personality to be self. I am the body, I am the personality. So Kanda Mara, the Mara that is the mind that believes the khandhas are real, that I am the body, I am the personality that takes the khandhas to be substantial and real. The fourth one, associated with sankhara, is called Abhisankhara Mara, and that's associated with thinking. So that's the Mara of opinions, like I'm right because I think it. If I think it, it's true. So the Mara that loves conceptual proliferation, the Mara that feels or knows that truth can be established in concepts, in numbers, in forms, in ideas. And so a lot of academic thinking, philosophy, and the is tied up with the Abhisankhara Mara, that the belief in thought and concept as an absolute reality. And then the fifth Mara is called Devaputta Mara, so that the highest of gods. So the Devaputta Mara is Mara in this instance is the ruler of the Paranimitta Vasavati heaven. So in Buddhist cosmology, you have the lower realms, the human realm, then the Deva realms. Seven of the Deva realms are called the Kamaloka, the sense pleasure or sense desire realms. And so the seventh of those is the Paranimitta Vasavati heaven, as we recite in the Dhammacakka Sutta. So the Mara, Devaputta Mara, is the king. He's the ruler of the Paranimitta Vasavati heaven. So above that is the Brahma worlds, the many, I think 22 Brahma worlds, up above, or even more actually. No, sorry, 22 Brahma worlds, that's right, up above that. But so Devaputta Mara is rather like the biblical Satan, Lucifer, as the brightest of archangels. Mara, Devaputta Mara, is the king of the Paranimitta Vasavati heaven. So is the ruler of the highest of the sensual heavens. So that is the Mara that believes that pleasure and goodness, even and brightness, are self. They are real. They are who and what we are. And so that maybe the question came from the highest gods and evil forces in the sharing of blessings. And so maybe the question was a lot simpler than my answer. But they're not entirely divided. In Buddhist cosmology, Mara, at least Devaputta Mara, is one of the higher gods. So way up higher than Indra and the heaven of the 33 or the two-seater heaven. So the Paranimitta Vasavati heaven is a quite a sublime realm. So Mara is the king of that heaven, Devaputta Mara. So that kind of influence in terms of psychology, it's the taking of even bright, beautiful of mind as being real, as being substantial, as being beautiful. So one of Longda Mahabua's most well-known talks is the radiant mind is ignorance, or the radiant mind is avijja, and he's talking, if I remember correctly, a lot about this, how if you take even that quality of inner brightness coming from profound concentration and wholesome qualities, if you take even that brightness as being real, substantial, and as some kind of a self, then right there you're creating the causes of dukkha. That so I think it's in we actually I think we included it in the book The Island. It's with the title The Radiant Mind is Unawareness, and Ajahn Tanisro has it in one or two of his books as well, with the same title. It was his translation we used. The Radiant Mind is Unawareness. And so that is tagging Mara as being the ruler of the Parinibbana Vasavati heaven, is like saying don't be attached or don't be identified even with bright, beautiful, wholesome states, because that can be very deceptive. Just as these inner voices, if the inner voices, you've got some kind of radiant being coming to you and saying, congratulations, you are fully and completely enlightened, now go out and tell the world. You say, oh wow, this is amazing. Beautiful Deva came and told me that I should go out and convert the world. Yeah, so you're out in the Marlows in Hemel Hempstead, proclaiming your truth to the 3.5 shoppers. Walking down the Marlows, that was not a bright being that should have been believed in. So Mara has many disguises. So I think that is enough for today. And thanks to everyone for your good attention, and for the tech team to set things up here in the temple. I hope that the broadcast has worked mostly. And also to consciously share the blessings of our lives, our practice with the world, those who are doing the helping, we are particularly grateful for, but also those who are living their quiet lives, cultivating the good and letting go of the harmful, in all of the many and various ways that these we're all making our contribution to the well-being of the planet and to our human family. Everyone.